Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning, and thanks for listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein, and now, time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
It's sad that them officers are still working, and we want them fired, and we demand that they be fired.
And the city attorney explained the Arizona legislature has given additional due process rights to police officers. This legislative session, they continued to expand that, so police officers have different due process rights than other city employees.
We want to see the corporation commission doing what their constitutional charge is, and if there's other opportunities around energy regulation and policy that the legislature or the governor's office should be involved in, we want to make certain that we're involved.
Right now there are 45,000 beds that we have a system designed for, but we have 52,000 in ICE custody. So we're overtaxed right there, and the money's going to run out. That's one of the reasons that we need the supplemental.
It's obviously some decision that was made in the wee hours of the morning, probably not very well thought out, and I would imagine it's a threat more than a reality.
And with us to talk about a couple of interesting meetings around police behavior in Phoenix, along with the politics of the Corporation Commission and more, our communications consultant Julie Earfley and former Paradise Valley Mayor Vernon Parker, also a member of the Bush administration. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Vernon, let me start with you with the Corporation Commission. You have your own experience running for the Corporation Commission. So-called dark money got you a little bit during the race. We could talk a bit about that later. But to start with, what do you make of the action by the Corporation Commission in this emergency meeting? And frankly, Governor Ducey's response almost saying, hey, Corporation Commissioners, that's not your duty.
Well, I believe that the governor is misinformed here. Most definitely agree with Chairman Burns or Commissioner Burns, and the fact that the Corporation Commission has constitutional authority to do rulemaking, judicial, but what I really wish that the governor had done was to focus really on APS, because here's the deal. He has never made a statement about the dark money spending. He has never said anything about that. And APS, for example, they cut off the electricity for 110,000 individuals, okay? Mm-hmm. And I think a couple people died. And so if that money that they used in the dark money campaign had been applied to assisting people in their utility bills, we wouldn't have had a premature death.
Yeah, Julie, where is it as far as APS goes? APS, very powerful utility. We still see ads for APS. Mm-hmm. And it does seem that since even when Vernon was running and maybe even a little bit before that, APS stepped into an area that many people did not expect. I don't know for a fact that APS wasn't involved in political campaigns before, but it was much more subtle. So right. What about the fact the Corporation Commission seems to be finally, at least in some steps, coming down on APS a bit?
Well, I think they're coming down on APS because the public is coming down on APS because we've had so much attention drawn to it. I don't think that APS is doing this out of any goodwill or because they choose to. I mean, APS has been put in a corner, particularly by Commissioners Burns and Kennedy. And so that's really what has changed. But even that really was, it was the public that was pushing it. It was all of this sort of, folks on both sides of the aisle really being frustrated with the dark money. And I think the reason that Governor Ducey isn't calling out the dark money by APS is because he has personally benefited from it. He's taking a stand now because, as we've seen, this governor seems to respond to heat, not so much light. And this is bringing about a lot of heat. But remember that APS and the governor are still very closely aligned. I mean, they actually, not only did they contribute to helping him get elected as governor, but they went so far as to help fund $1 million ad campaign when he was behind in the polls on education and when education was the number one issue. So they are very closely aligned. I don't foresee the governor saying anything about dark money.
Do either of you see this incident where this woman in Sun City West passed away after her power was turned off? The autopsy revealed that it was a heat-related death. Do either of you consider this maybe a turning point in how APS is viewed sort of by the wider population, or how APS takes part in politics or the governing process?
I think they're in a PR nightmare, to be totally honest. I think you're going to see them running more ads and trying to sort of defend the work, the good work that they do. I think that it's definitely a turning point. I think you're going to have ratepayers now who are demanding that they take a good hard look at that 2017 rate case and stop punting on it and start demanding that they do more to address these very high rates. And I think that obviously that's good news for ratepayers, bad news for APS.
I could not agree more. And I really do believe that the governor's heart is in the right place, but I believe that when you personally benefit from dark money, it's going to make it very difficult for you to take that positive stand. And I know the governor personally, and I know that he cares about the state, he cares about the ratepayers, but I just really hope that he would get the courage to stand up to APS and to say, I am the governor of the people of the state of Arizona, not the governor for APS.
Well, what about the politics of this overall? Bob Burns was on Horizon the other night, and Bob Burns does not really say a whole lot, but when he said it, it was in very clipped sentences, asked about whether the governor, in saying that maybe they were overstepping their bounds, he said, well, he's wrong. Just have him read the Constitution. Is this somewhere we could see, again, sort of an intra-party battle there because of what's going on with this? Could we see the governor taking on the Corporation Commission and vice versa, or does this blow over soon?
Well, the governor's point is that he would like the governor's office to participate. There's nothing wrong with that, because I'm sure that there is a liaison between the governor's office and the Corporation Commission. Now, I totally agree with Commissioner Burns, because they have the constitutional authority to enact rules and to also act as a quasi-judicial branch. And so this authority is in the Constitution. And so I believe that they should work together with the governor's office to come up with the policies that would personally benefit the ratepayers of the state.
There's also an opportunity for the governor to work with the legislature on this. He had an opportunity this last legislative session. He took a pass. I mean, Senator Juan Mendez had a bill out there that addressed not being able to turn off power when the temperatures got too high or too low. Remember, we do have northern Arizona here as well. And that got no support because it was just Democrats who had sponsored that bill. That's unfortunate. If the governor wants to take a stance, he could work with Senator Mendez and bring this back next legislative session. That's not impossible.
Vernon, the phrase mission creep, though, what the governor said, that sounds, to me at least, like more than I'd like my office to sort of have a seat at the table. That sounds almost like you guys are doing stuff you shouldn't be doing. You guys are doing stuff that I should and the legislature should be doing.
No, I totally, I disagree with that, because I do believe that Commissioner Burns is 100% correct. The Constitution gives the Corporation Commission the authority to do the things that they are doing. And the Constitution also took a look to say, this is an independent voice. And so they should be independent.
Right. But in terms of what the governor had said, where he had said that the commission was sort of overstepping its bounds a little bit, I guess the question is, does it sound to you like the governor is saying that maybe in his mind anyway, it's not so much he wants to sort of be involved in the process, he wants the commission to sort of step down a little bit based on what it's doing?
Yeah, but I don't think they should. I think they're doing what is constitutionally put forth. And so I think APS may have some role here in the statement that the governor made. And so I really hope that that is not the case, but it has been shown that in the past that the governor has not said anything contrary to APS whatsoever. And so
which may be some mission creep right there.
Right. Well, Julie, how big a battle is there potentially then between, from this political standpoint, if Vernon's right and maybe APS has the ear of the governor or maybe more than that, are we looking at something here which could end up being sort of a fight between commissioners and the governor's office because of all this?
I think so. I think the interesting thing will be how does the new commissioner, Leah Marquez Peterson, weigh into all of this? I mean, when we are talking about mission creep, perhaps we should talk about that. Perhaps we should talk about the fact that the governor removed somebody who was duly elected and placed one of his own picks into that position, which I think is very concerning considering the fact that Marquez Peterson has extremely close ties to APS as well, mainly from her time with the Chamber of Commerce. And so I don't know how Marquez Peterson will react as a commissioner on that board, and I don't want to make statements assuming that I know, but I think that that will really provide a lot of interesting insight as to what happens on the Corporation Commission if we get this split between those who feel like we need to rein in what's going on with dark money and APS and those who feel like, no, we need to keep APS in our corner.
And Vernon, finally, before the break, though, I wanted to ask you about this. So as a Republican, you were running for office as a Republican. Mm-hmm. Were you surprised that APS came out after you so aggressively?
I was shocked. I mean, I was just because I was pro-solar, and that was a crime, you know. But I tell people, when all of this did occur, I was up in the polls by about 15 points. And my only mission statement was to do what was best for the ratepayers, not what's best for APS or the solar industry. And so, but I was shocked to have, you know, $3.5 million spent saying that Vernon Parker is this horrible person. And believe me, there is no way that anyone could beat $3.5 million versus 100,000.
Yeah. That's Vernon Parker. Also here is Julie Earthly with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're in the midst of the newscap, which continues after this. Good morning. Thanks for listening to the Friday Newscap here on KJZZ's The Show with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guests today are former Paradise Valley Mayor Vernon Parker and communications consultant Julie Earthly.
And guys, before we move on to another topic, I wanted to ask one more question about APS and Governor Ducey's comments. And I'm wondering if you guys think this is the kind of thing that will continue to be a conversation when the legislature comes back. Do you think that there's any chance that there will be some kind of battle, power struggle between the executive and the legislative branch of government and the Corporation Commission? Or is this just something we're talking about in mid-June?
I don't see it with the legislature. I think, by and large, Republicans at the legislature are pretty, they're pretty joined at the hip when it comes to a lot of these issues. I don't think it's a huge issue for them, to be totally honest. I think the action is going to stay at the Corporation Commission. I just haven't seen a willingness by the legislature, any Republican legislators so far, to go up against APS really on any bills.
Vernon, what do you think?
No, I agree 100%. The only thing that I can hope for is that the commissioners will continue to fight for the citizens and, you know, and just disregard the chitter-chatter in the background.
Vernon, let's move on to a huge community meeting that took place in Phoenix this week, led by Mayor Kate Gallego and Police Chief Jerry Williams. And then we had a contentious city council meeting the next day related to a viral video focusing on one or two police officers as far as their behavior, which people are concerned may have been racially motivated. Where do you look at this right now as far as what the situation surrounding police and African Americans in the Valley, or even around the country, and what the council could or should be doing, or what Chief Williams could or should be doing?
Yeah, well, first of all, let me say it was a very sad day for the Phoenix Police Department. And on the other hand, it was a very good day because Chief Williams, I thought, did an incredible job. She stepped up to the plate. She said that we have a problem. And so hopefully that problem will be corrected. Now, but we have some huge issues here because if you take a look, I think there was an article that just came out that said that in the city of Phoenix, they have shot more people than any other, the police officers have shot at more people than any other city in the United States. They shot 44 times in 2018, and City of New York, they fired 23 times. The city of Philadelphia, they fired 12 times. And city of Dallas, 4 times. And the numbers of firing were very disproportionate with African Americans. It was almost twice as many. But I do believe that Chief Williams, she will take control. She inherited this department, but she's doing the right thing. She's talking to the citizens. She's talking to the you know, entire city council. So hopefully something good will come from this.
Julie, the big question, of course, is that there are certain officers who have behavior issues, most of whom do not. So where does Chief Williams go with this in terms of obviously having to make the public feel confident, but also wanting to make sure that, that those she leads know that they have her support?
This is a tough issue. I think I was glad to hear Councilman Garcia talk about this ad hoc committee. The issue with the ad hoc committee is who's on the ad hoc committee, to be totally honest. My biggest fear, I mean, this is very personal for
right.
me.
Thank you for talking about it.
You know, my husband was a Phoenix police officer who was killed in the line of duty. And so it's hard for me to listen to individuals. I understand there needs to be progress made, and I am fully behind that and the idea that we need to have this ad hoc committee to listen to each other. But it's hard as somebody whose husband has given his life for this community to hear people refer with very blanket statements that all police officers are murderers, kidnappers, et cetera. That's extremely distressing. And I think what it does is it pushes people into corners. And my fear is this turns into like an immigration issue. It turns into this wedge issue where we're either pro or anti-police. And that's the last thing we need. We don't need people shoved into their corners feeling as if they're constantly in defensive mode, like I'm being attacked or you're being attacked and so on. And so I think we need people on this ad hoc committee who are willing to come in and truly listen. What is going on in these communities? Why are communities of color feeling this way? This is a problem. And why are officers feeling as if they are constantly being attacked? Like, what's really going on there as well? So I think this is a chief who is willing to listen and willing to take action. It will be interesting to see what comes from that ad hoc committee, but definitely I think there needs to be some kind of steps that come forward. If we simply have listening sessions, we're not going to solve this issue, and I think it will continue to boil up and get worse and worse.
That's very, very good statement. But I will tell you, I've known Chief Williams for about 15 years, and she is going to do something. Her heart's in the right place. She will not deliver lip service. So she is in action. So she will get things done.
Julie, do you have optimism that there is a place for nuance in this conversation as opposed to, as you described, people sort of in their corners and just talking at each other as opposed to talking to each other and listening to each other?
To be totally honest, I think the general public understands the nuance. I do really feel that way. I think what it is you've got activists who are understandably upset, and so they've come at it feeling as if this is the only way that they can come at it, is if they sort of make a very big statement. And then you've got officers who are feeling attacked. And so you've got those groups who are the most vocal, who are really kind of just yelling past each other and not talking to each other. But I think, in all honesty, I think the general public does understand that there is some nuance there. And I think the chief needs to be the face of this and needs to lead it, as well as Mayor Gallego, and talk about those nuances so that we kind of keep that at the forefront.
So, Vernon, given that, does maybe the general public then become maybe more important in this conversation than, for lack of a better word, the usual suspects, the people who are typically involved in these kinds of conversations?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very, very tense situation right now, because law enforcement, they put their lives on the line every single day. And it really pains me a lot when people say all policemen are bad, you know. But having grown up in the African-American community myself, I've been the victim personally of having policemen draw guns on me 3 or 4 times. But on the other hand, my brother served as a L.A. Deputy County Sheriff for 30 years. He put his life on the line. And so I really do believe what we really need is more community involvement with police officers, getting to know the community, not just sitting in a vehicle. But we are in a very tense situation now, and I think that Jerry Williams is the right person right now. She's lived in South Phoenix. She knows the community. She understands. She supports the police officers also. And so hopefully through community involvement, we can get this thing done.
Vernon, do you think the department's move to speed up the rollout of body-worn cameras for officers, will that make a difference in this conversation, do you think?
Absolutely, if it's done the right way, too, because we have to make sure, because, you know, a lot of the he said, she said, hearsay things will be eliminated immediately. And so the body cams, I know she's already done a good job of putting it in the neighborhood where the incident did occur. So absolutely.
I agree. Yeah, I think that the body cams, I think anytime there's more transparency, more accountability, that's a good thing. And I think it helps both people, because when you see part of a video, you don't always see the full story. Now there's an opportunity to see the entire encounter, and I think that that's very important.
Yeah, I think we should have body cams in here for you guys, too, so we can see if you guys are doing the right theme here for NPR. Okay?
Less than a minute here, guys. So let's talk about, we talk about leadership from Gallego and Williams. Are there going to be pretty major bumps along the road to get to, if there even is optimism, is there going to be a lot of continuing tension here? Because the body cameras, social media, things have changed, so we find out about these things. And some of them are very significant. Some of them, some would say, are blown out of proportion. So
I think there's definitely going to be a lot of bumps in the road. I see Gallego and Chief Williams working together very well, which is important, and I do see leadership to date from those two. I think we need other members on the council to follow that lead. We need to tone down the rhetoric, not just from both sides that are sort of yelling past each other, but also from the council as well. I mean, we need to be working towards that solution. And I think until we do that, we're not going to get there.
Just a few seconds, Vern.
Yeah, real quickly. I think that the body cams will be fantastic. However, we also have to understand that there are underlying issues that the body cameras may not pick up on. And so we have to be very, very careful about that.
That's former Paradise Valley Mayor Vernon Parker and communications consultant Julie Earthley. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Good Friday morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. A reminder to stay tuned at 10 o'clock this morning for The Takeaway. As the Phoenix Police Department speeds up deployment of body-worn cameras for patrol officers and patrol sergeants, we're learning more about how they work and what's not yet working. From KJZZ's Downtown Bureau, Christina Estes reports.
So camera functionality.
At the South Mountain Precinct Thursday afternoon.
You're going to turn it to your left. Turn the camera to your left and take it off, all right?
Sergeant Kevin Johnson walks a squad through body-worn cameras. Right away, this catches my ear.
To record, you're going to press that big button in the middle. That's an event button. You're going to press it twice. So when you press it twice, you'll feel it vibrate. It is now recording audio and video.
His instructions on how to turn on the cameras seem to contradict earlier expectations laid out by Chief Jerry Williams. In January, she told the Public Safety Subcommittee cameras would increase trust, increase officer safety, and eliminate human error by having to turn on and off cameras as dictated.
The automatic activation features we had mentioned were the officer opening his or her car door, and or if they turn on the lights and siren on the car, it would automatically activate. But again, you have that component in there that if they're going to the restroom or having lunch or doing other things, they could turn it off. But they're required by policy to turn it on in situations where we're engaging with the public.
So it's not the officer turning it on or off, it's automatically turned?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Department spokesperson Sergeant Tommy Thompson says automatic activation is a feature they have not yet used in the three precincts where more than 600 cameras have been assigned.
The automatic turn-on point, that's one thing that we'll go with downrange. But before we go down there, we want to make sure people understand, hey, I've got to turn it on. I'm responsible for this camera, not some automatic switch. And that's part of the training we want to have.
A 2015 ASU study on Phoenix's pilot program in the Maryvale precinct found a significant decline in complaints against officers wearing cameras and an increase in unfounded complaints against officers wearing cameras.
All right. What I want you guys to do is come on up here and grab your cameras.
By mid-August, Phoenix expects to have 1,200 cameras deployed across all 7 precincts. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
On Thursday, the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services notified the facility where a woman was raped and later gave birth to a baby that it would terminate its Medicaid certification. The reason, as KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports, is that Hacienda Healthcare once again failed to keep its residents safe.
On May 8th, CMS surveyors and the State Department of Health went out to Hacienda on a post-certification revisit and to follow up on a complaint. Will Humble is the executive director for the Arizona Public Health Association. He's also the former head of DHS.
But there were some pretty significant deficiencies that were found in an inspection in real early May. So, and that was both a federal certification inspection and then the state licensing inspection.
John Myers is the executive director with the ARC of Arizona, a disability advocacy group. He says he's surprised it's come to this.
Because I really thought Hacienda would get its act together, given the amount of time that it has had since the rape and pregnancy incident, given the amount of oversight that's been conducted by the state and by CMS.
The feds will revoke Hacienda's certification on July 3rd. The state issued its notice of intent to revoke Hacienda's license last week after maggots were found on a resident's tracheotomy incision. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
During an emergency meeting yesterday, the Arizona Corporation Commission voted to keep electric companies it regulates, including Arizona Public Service, from shutting off service to customers who are behind in their bills during the state's hottest time of year, June 1st until October 15th. The action was taken in response to reporting that revealed 72-year-old Stephanie Pullman died last year when APS turned off her power. Pullman owed the utility $51. With me to talk about the Corporation Commission's action is consumer advocate Stacey Champion. So, Stacey, what do you think of what the commissioners did, and is it enough, at least in the short term?
I think there has been an emergency. I think it was incredibly reactive versus proactive, which is disappointing. It was also interesting for me to hear how many years it's been. I believe Commissioner Boyd Dunn mentioned the number of years that it's been since they have even reviewed their own policies. That was kind of a shocker to me. I would say that if I were a commissioner, that would be one of the first things I would be interested in doing coming on to that governing body would be to review all of the policies and procedures, quite frankly.
Some would say, well, okay, once the Corporation Commission found out about it, you know, if they should have known before, that they did take relatively quick action. From that standpoint, does that indicate to you that at least maybe this is a current makeup of the panel that might actually be willing to take action on things?
This isn't something that the Arizona Corporation Commission found out about just last week. They found out about it in September of 2018 when Stephanie Pullman's daughter called the Corporation Commission mm-hmm. to file a informal, air quotes, complaint about what happened. So I would, I guess, ask the question, what are they doing with their own internal policies to have something like this not be elevated all the way up to the commission when it happened 9 months ago.
Mm-hmm. So someone we talk to very frequently is Ryan Randazzo, who covers utilities for the Arizona Republic. And we've discussed with him what could be next. You were obviously, again, heavily involved in getting the Corporation Commission to look again at the rate hike.
Yeah, way more so than I would want, than I even want to be, trust me.
Of course. No, I get that. So we discussed with Ryan the possibility of what could happen next when, because the commission wants another rate case to be able to talk to APS about what's going on. And there was even speculation that that might actually lead to rates generally going up. For an advocate standpoint, how does that make you feel to say that, okay, you're getting out there, you're making people take a much closer look at what APS has done and what the previous commissioners had approved, and then it might end up leading to more rate hikes?
Well, I think that we're definitely hitting a tipping point, if you will, with everything that's come into the light with regard to the 2018 shutoff numbers being up over 110,000. this death of Stephanie Pullman, we're naive to think that she is the only one, given the indoor heat-related death numbers going up every year. And so the Corporation Commission has a tool that they could use. They have ARS 40-252 that I do hope that they will finally get the spine or the courage or what have you to see that the immediate need for some relief for these customers whose bills are just too high. Stephanie Pullman wouldn't have been in the situation she was in if her bills hadn't gone up, and they did go up. And I know they went up because I had my expert analyze what bills I could get from her family. And so there is no doubt that this rate hike has massively impacted people's lives, especially those on fixed incomes, especially those who are just kind of like many people out there living paycheck to paycheck to just get by.
So where are we at in terms of what you think is possible? Because some will argue, well, Pinnacle West is a public company. They need to make some money. They need to have some profits. How do we balance it out?
I mean, as a small business owner, I get it, right? Like, I understand, like, businesses are in the business to make money. But I think that there is less of an inherent risk as there used to be. And so if you look at wonky things like the adjusters that are affecting bills but happening outside of the rate cases, I think there are 8 or 9 of them at this point. I think one thing that the commission should be doing is looking at whether or not that 10% return on investment is fair at this point. I think that the monopoly situation, it doesn't work for us anymore.
Consumer advocate Stacey Champion. Stacey, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve.
President Trump kicked off his re-election campaign officially in Florida this week and used many familiar talking points from the 2016 race. That year, he became the 4th consecutive Republican, following George W. Bush, John McCain, and Mitt Romney to win Arizona. But because Trump's victory was narrow in the state, Democrats here think 2020 may be their first chance to have their party's presidential nominee be the winner here since Bill Clinton. With me to talk about that is Arizona Democratic Party Chair Felicia Rodellini. So, Felicia, as I mentioned, the president has begun his reelection campaign. What are his chances of winning in Arizona in 2020?
The fact that Donald Trump only won Arizona in 2016 by 3.5% with very little investment by Hillary Clinton tells us that this is truly an opportunity for the next Democratic candidate to go up against Donald Trump. Last year, we knew we had a chance to win. We built a historic field program that turned out not just Democrats, but independents and Republicans who were fed up with the Republicans in Washington as well as in Arizona. And we're already investing in our field program to make sure that we're ready and stronger than ever.
Now, you know the history, of course, that the last Democrat to win Arizona was Bill Clinton. Before that, it was Harry Truman. So a lot of years in between there. So does this rest more on the effort you're talking about or more on the fact that maybe people will see Donald Trump as not a good choice?
Well, the Democrats in 2020 will be doing what we did in 2018, and that is talk about the values, talk about the issues that transcend party politics and the issues that right now only the Democratic candidates and the Democrats care about, and Donald Trump and the Republicans have continued to destroy. And I'm talking about health care and affordable health care, education. He has appointed a person to run the Department of Education that wants to do nothing but destroy access to great public education. Support for seniors, which will be a very hot topic in Arizona. We need to protect Social Security and Medicare. And Donald Trump has said in his second term, those programs will be on the chopping block. So these are the most important issues to Arizonans, and they're the issues that are most in jeopardy if Donald Trump gets a second term.
So next week, we'll see the first two as they're paired up for the Democratic presidential candidates for the debate. Does there need to be at the top of the ticket ultimately for the Democrats to win Arizona? Does there have to be someone who would be a so-called moderate?
Well, I'm excited about the debates because we're going to have a good 18 months of vetting the Democratic candidates and seeing who is the strongest and who most reflects the values of not only Arizona, but all Americans. And it's going to be a candidate who will resonate, with Arizonans and will speak about values. I think that any Democrat that comes out of the presidential primary and is our ultimate choice has a great chance of winning against Donald Trump, because Donald Trump is not talking about the values that matter to Arizonans and has a record of doing everything he can to undermine those values.
Is there a concern about the intra-party battle and that the candidates will knock each other down too much?
The Democrats understand that we have to be unified and that, quite frankly, this is a presidential campaign for us to win, and we need to get behind our candidate. The candidate that's going to be the most acceptable and the most irresistible to the Democrats and will make it through the primary will be the one that displays all of the best aspects of being an American, from being patriotic and a fighter for human rights and equal rights to being someone who's reasonable and who's going to solve problems. The issues in 2018 and the issues in 2020, and quite frankly, in any election cycle, are about who is the leader who will solve problems.
Hillary Clinton didn't spend a lot of time or money in Arizona, and now we're seeing Arizona become characterized as more of a purple state, maybe based on what happened in 2018. Do you feel confident that Arizona will get the attention that many people here think it deserves?
Oh, Arizona is getting the attention that we deserve. We are officially a battleground state, according to the Democratic National Committee. And we have had many candidates already come through Arizona and have called me and other leaders in the Democratic Party here in Arizona. And so for the next several months, I believe right up until Election Day, Democrats, Republicans, and independents in Arizona will have an opportunity to see these candidates up close and personal. We know that the Republicans are concerned that they could lose Arizona, and that's what makes a battleground. The Republicans are going to work just as hard to keep Arizona red as the Democrats have already begun to fight to make sure that a Democrat wins in 2020 and takes over the White House.
That is Felicia Rodolini. She is chair of the Arizona Democratic Party. Felicia, great to catch up with you. Thank you.
It's great to talk to you always. Thank you.
Today is the summer solstice, the longest day of the year. It's also legendary Arizona architect Paulo Soleri's birthday. So our co-host Lauren Gilger took a drive up north to Soleri's experimental community of Arco Santi recently to take a tour and learn more about where it sits 50 years in. Hey, Lauren.
Hey, guys. So I went up there and met longtime resident and senior advisor Mary Hoadley recently. And when I say longtime, I mean it. Hoadley has lived in this alternative kind of city since 1970 when construction there began. She was just out of college, and she said her college boyfriend came to Arco Santi to work for Soleri, and she came to visit him for 2 weeks and never left.
Frankly, it was just so exciting to me that Soleri was going off out here into the wilderness, in a way, to try to do something so radically different, but that touched all of those issues that for me were important in the 60s as a college student then, from the environment to segregation to, you know, inequality of access to the good things of life, war, all those things Soleri was trying to touch with this very simple idea of, well, let's try to do something different about the way we organize the built environment. And to me, that was, I don't know, I got addicted.
Solari studied under Frank Lloyd Wright, and his resulting work shows both what he learned from the architectural master and how he wanted to push beyond it. Arcosanti was meant to be a new way of life that combats the massive sprawl that he saw developing in the world around him. But 50 years later, what was planned for the community is only 3% built. But Hoadley says the vision continues despite that.
A lot of people say, oh, Arcosanti is supposed to be like this utopia. It's this ideal. And it's not that at all. It's just meant to be an expression of that idea of coming together. And this is one way, one aspect of how it could happen. But for Solari, all life is evolutionary. It's a process. We're constantly moving and developing and hopefully learning from now, from the past, and trying to create, you know, a better future.
Solari died in 2013 at age 93, and his name has become somewhat marred in recent years after one of his daughters came forward in 2017 accusing him of sexual abuse. Hoadley says that's been difficult for her and for some of the other people who have really dedicated their lives to the project, but she stressed as we walked around the grounds that this place is about much more than Solari himself.
It's really important walking around to remember that at least 10,000 people paid to work over the last 50 years to put everything here that's here, even though what we have is only 3% of what we want to build. But that commitment of people inspired by Solari to not only bring resources in terms of paying a workshop fee, but then to stay here 6 weeks or longer to actually contribute 40 hours a week of work is really extraordinary. Oh, this is just like the most perfect day.
So this is it's built on a hillside here, right? Yeah, like you're looking down over this sort of canyon.
Right. So that was one of the things that Solari decided to do when he found this site. So we do own 860 acres here, surrounded by 3,200 acres of state grazing lease. And we are committed to only build on maybe 25 acres of that 860, and that's to stick with this commitment to have bounded density. And so instead of building on the flat, which we do have some flat agricultural land along the Agua Fria River that bisects the property, there's this commitment to build on the marginal land, the hillside, the difficult site. But that gives you this wonderful opportunity for views and really interesting architecture.
Yeah.
So now we've come to the ceramics apse, and it's essentially a quarter of a sphere. And what Solari understood early on was if you site this facing south in the summer, as we're approaching now, the apse provides a shaded outdoor workspace. In the winter, when the sun's much lower in the sky compared to us, it's a sun trap. So we'd be out here freezing, and Maddie, who's in there working, would be at her shirt sleeves. So all his architecture tries to consider the elements, whether it's the sun, the orientation, or the way the winds blow, et cetera. So he's very aware of the environment.
And this was part of his entire philosophy, right? This arcology that he created.
Right. Arcology, architecture, and ecology, the idea of that architecture, that they're symbiotic. So he understood early on, sort of as a principle of life, that as things get more complex, they tend to get more compact. He called it miniaturized. He felt that the built environment should take into account that kind of principle. So that's how he came up with the idea of arcology as a dense, bounded, three-dimensional plumbing system that provides all the good things of urban living, variety of activities, opportunities for different people to meet each other, etc., your own private housing, but then this instant access, not mediated by the automobile, to all those wonderful aspects of urban living. And at the same time, when that kind of density and almost intensity, you've reached your limit, well, you can just look outward to the natural environment, or you can just take a little walk and you're in it. You don't have to get in an automobile, plan a trip to the White Mountains, get stuck in traffic getting there, et cetera.
I mean, like, so that's so relevant today, right? Like, and probably more relevant today than it ever was when he even began this philosophy, because we talk so much about sustainability now. We talk so much about creating ways to live that are not going to continue to impact our environment in the way that they have. And that's essentially what he was doing way before that was even, way before sustainability was even a word.
Right. Well, he had that understanding that the current model, the automobile-driven model, the constant sprawl development single-family home model, that the logical conclusion of that was spreading over everything, what he would call the time-space straitjacket, where if the further you have to live out to get affordable housing, the longer it takes you to commute to work, you know, all those issues. He did, at Frank Lloyd Wright's, he was exposed to Broadacre City, which was Wright's idea that he developed in the 30s, which is really the basis for the whole suburban development that we have today. When he saw Broadacre City, you know, he understood the logical conclusion of it, and so therefore he came up with his own idea, which is radically different, which is compact, three-dimensional apartment living, not single-family home living.
So it was an adoption of some of the things and a rejection of some of the others.
Yeah. Well, maybe not reject, but reaction to, and maybe building on.
Tell me a little bit about While We Walk Here. Tell me a little bit about what kept you here all those years. Like, I can understand as a college student being inspired by that and deciding to stay, but I mean, this is decades and decades later.
Well, for me, the simple idea is so worthy and so deserving of energy. And I think, but here, this is like an incredibly authentic experience of people working together to do something meaningful, to work on something larger than yourself. And I think all of us need to have some larger organizing thing in our lives that helps direct our good energy. So, you know, the first years here, we thought we'd build Arcosani in 5 years for 3,000 people. And then
the entire city?
Oh, yeah, of course. Well, this was sitting around the campfire, you know, the first summer. And then we would be in high demand to go all over the world, work with indigenous populations, help them get organized to build in a self-reliant way little urban centers. So you could have a model where people who've been agriculturalists all their lives could continue the agricultural connection, but they'd have access to that the urban living, which is variety, inspiration, so there could be a balance in their lives, and there would be a big improvement in the whole planet. You know, we thought we were going to save the world that way.
So 50 years later, and you're still here, and 3% is built. It's not like there's no hope. There's is obviously a vibrant place, but how does that feel? How do you reconcile, you know, sort of the loss of that?
Well, for me, it's the two sides of the coin. You know, you could say, wow, this is not much to show for 50 years of work. But on the other side of it, this is an improbable accomplishment here, this focusing of the energy of so many people to build what's here that can function as an inspiration to every new person that comes here.
Can we see the amphitheater?
Sure, yeah. Kali Soleri Amphitheater. In the East Crescent Complex here. We started back in 1975, and it's still underway. And we did have 2,000 people here 2 weeks ago for Form, and it was wonderful. I saw Pussy Riot here, incredible performance, Florence and the Machine. They had like 32 different incredible contemporary acts over 3 days that were extraordinary.
When you're looking at sort of Form and some of these really successful events that have come to Arcosanti just in recent years and the popularity of it, like it's growing, I think, in terms of just its recognition, and it's a cool thing these days, you know? How do you reconcile that and the way that it's being perceived maybe outside of this place by the rest of the world and the original vision and the things that were originally intended here? Do you think that they can kind of live in harmony?
Yeah, I think they complement each other. That was one of the thoughts I had during Forum was, okay, there's 2,500 people here. That's half our target population. Isn't it wonderful to see these spaces densely populated with activity? I mean, for me, the whole point of this is not to just sit here as an architectural monument, but to be used. There's a heavy emphasis on trying to show people by example what the values are here and to try to educate people about them while they're here and to appreciate that they're here. Just that experience of, oh, wow, this is beautiful. I mean, that's the reaction, the inescapable reaction of the place. The key aspects of this place speak to people that come here. And to have 2,500 people be exposed to me is like, it's wonderful.
Mary Hoadley, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. So glad that you've been here on this most beautiful of days. We'll be right back.
All right, so we know where Steve Goldstein was last night, glued to his television and Twitter, I suspect, following the NBA draft. He is, of course, the number one fan of the Phoenix Suns, who does not dress in an orange bodysuit, at least as far as I know.
Yeah.
So,
well, you would know better than anybody else.
I probably would.
I shouldn't have said that on the air.
So the Suns, before the draft started, they traded T.J. Warren, who's been there for a few years, pretty good scorer. They traded a second-round pick. They ended up trading their top pick. What do you think?
Yeah, they've been getting tremendous criticism, which of course makes sense because we don't know who these players are yet. And they traded a player that people, when he was on the court, was a good player. But I think I come back to this, Mark. Here's my philosophy.
Okay.
First of all, optimism is the way to go in life. Everyone, all you kids out there. The other thing
you
is
should be writing this down, people.
They had the second worst record in the organization's history last year. So my feeling is what they were doing before wasn't working. So, you know, why not try something a little bit different?
Yeah. Well, and as you said, you were kind of giving a scouting report on the two guys they got, the forward from North Carolina and a guard from Virginia, two very, like, basketball IQ guys and two good shooters.
Yeah, experienced guys, not guys who played 1 year in college. And also, if we look at the character issue, you want guys who are going to come in and play. If you go for the, this is how you look at it. Here's NBA scouting vernacular.
Okay.
So rather than going for guys with high upside, they went for guys with a high floor. So guys who you know are going to be solid, maybe not stars. That's sort of how I think of us.
I'm not sure what to make of that. So, like, how do you think these guys fit in with what they've got, with Booker and Ayton and Mikal Bridges and a new head coach, of course?
Well, I think it's going to be fantastic. Are you kidding me?
Okay. So, championship next year?
Yeah, probably next year.
Goodbye Raptors?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, let's do it. Why not, right?
All right.
Phil Latzman was on this program a few weeks ago. He said championship next year.
For the Suns.
Break out the champagne and the cigars. Absolutely.
Not like somebody's going to win the championship.
Someone,
the Suns.
The Suns.
Okay.
Yes,
absolutely. All right. We'll have to see about that.
Okay. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.